Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Most organizations have access to incredibly powerful technologies, but struggle to use them to their full potential. Bent Ears team of experienced technology and operations professionals systematically help organizations get the most out of the technology they already own. You can find them at www.BentEarSolutions.com. Welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. I'm Eric Holdeman, your host. With me today is Tanya Franson, meteorologist in charge of National Weather Service office in Portland, Oregon. We'll be discussing weather forecasting in general and doing it in a time of climate change and El Nino. So please join me in welcoming Tanya to the Disaster Zone podcast.
Hi, Eric. Can't believe we've known each other 20 years and we finally get to do something official together.
Yeah, and I'm not old either. I'm just...
Neither am I.
No, there we go.
We got many disasters left in our belts, don't we?
Okay, and I have no hair, and your hair is not gray, so whatever makes that happen. Well, listen, we have known one another for a little bit, but our audience doesn't know you, and I've never heard you talk about what has been your education career path up until today, and why did you choose the meteorology field?
You know, I loved science growing up. I was able to participate with my volunteer fire department when I was in high school, and I really enjoyed the emergency response side of things. As I was kind of looking for options for schools and things, science just stood out to me. And during my senior year, right before I started in high school, the Lyman, Colorado tornado happened. It was an F3, but it was all over the news. And, you know, living in Colorado, everyone says they have the worst weather. I think every state has that option of saying that. But, you know, I would watch it snow 6 inches, the sun would come out, it would melt. And then 3 hours later, we'd get some thunder snow and we'd get 3 more inches. And by the next day, it'd be gone. And it was intriguing to me. You know, what was so interesting about it? I liked biology, but I knew there was no way I could remember all the muscles and all the bones in the body and keep going down that track. And I really liked kind of the experiments we did in our physics class. The formulas were hard to remember, but the hands-on stuff was always really cool. So I went to the University of Northern Colorado, staying in state. You know, this was before the internet was really an option to go and look at other schools and opportunities. And so they had a meteorology program, the only one at the state of Colorado at the time. And, you know, it was a smaller campus. I grew up in a smaller location. I wasn't looking to go to a school where you kind of get lost in a sea of students. So it was a nice small program. And, you know, while I was my junior year, my professor came to me and said, "Would you like to work as an intern, you know, in an internship with the National Weather Service? I've got two people that I can recommend to the Weather Service in Cheyenne, Wyoming." And yeah, of course I want to do that. You know, my fire background, I was learning more about what incident meteorologists do on wildfires. And I just thought, this is kind of the route I want to go. So, you know, it's been a 30-year career. I was an IMET for a year of that. But most of my time is... What?
We're acronym free.
Oh, yeah. Incident meteorologists.
Okay, there you go.
But most of that time in that 30-year career has been working with the public, working with emergency managers, trying to get communities prepared, whether it was, you know, preparedness for one event or writing mitigation plans. I spent many years helping counties in Montana putting their mitigation plans together, some of the first ones in the country that were approved.
Okay. All right. And you were a warning officer. I know when I met you originally.
Yep. Warning coordination meteorologist for 14 years.
Okay. And then here you are in Portland. When did that all happen?
I moved here a year and a half ago. I was ready for some new challenges. And I'm going to be honest, the cold weather in Montana was a little bit rough to take. I was done with 35 below zero temperatures. I had the opportunity to come here. I have family in the area. My parents got married out in Etarts in Oregon. So I had some loose ties and I visited. It was an area that I could appreciate for sure. And the staff here had a great reputation. It was an office that needed a new leader, and I was thankfully able to come here. And this team was amazing. You walk into an office sometimes and you worry about the culture and trying to fit in, but they're just outstanding. I'm just really lucky to have the crew that we have here.
Okay, that's great. And so, how big is the crew? How many staff is in a? I don't know whether if there's such a thing as a typical weather service office, but how many do you have, and how's that compared to other places?
It's anywhere from 22 to about 28. We're at the 28 level. We have several more electronics technicians to maintain things like the radar, the observation stations at airports, the NOAA weather radio transmitters. So yeah, at 28 when we're fully staffed. I did a lot of hiring when I got here. We didn't have any electronics technicians pretty much. One was retiring and out the door, and so we actually brought in 32 visiting electronics technicians over about 15 months to help fill in. And, getting to meet people from around the country and see what they do at other offices was really, really cool.
Okay. So how's that size compared to other offices?
Other
Are there
offices, we're kind of at the higher end than some. I think, New York City and Los Angeles probably have one or two more people than we do, but
Okay.
We do have additional staffing, thankfully, and we
What
need it for the population we have.
and how about in Wyoming? How big is that office?
Those would be probably about 22 to 23 people, depending
Okay.
on
But still
the office.
about
Yeah.
same size. All right. And I just want to remind people, a lot of times national news, they say, well, 35 degrees below zero temperatures, they don't always add, and that's with windshield, but you're talking about a real
That's
35
actual
degrees.
temperature. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We'll go
Exactly.
60, 70 below with the wind chill, and
That
it's
that's
hard
right.
to live that way sometimes.
And last fall I had the opportunity to go to Mount Washington in Is it Maine or New Hampshire? Well,
New
which
Hampshire.
New
Yeah.
Hampshire? That is a cold place in October too. I should send you a picture. It was
Yeah, I bet it was windy up there too, wasn't
yes,
it?
frozen in. Okay, well, how about explaining the National Weather Service's system of field offices? Are there larger districts, or how's it all arranged, if you will? And has there been consolidation? We've seen consolidation in a lot of different types of organizations, whether that's happened to the National Weather Service also, maybe. I don't know.
We did a major consolidation and reorganization in the 1990s, and a lot of things changed. Smaller offices that only had four or five people in them closed, and we created bigger offices that do all the forecasting and services. But just let's picture a triangle. In the bottom of the triangle, you have 122 Weather Service forecast offices that are across the entire country, out in Guam, Puerto Rico, American Samoa. There's, Alaska, Hawaii. We have all these forecast offices that have anywhere from that 22 to 28 employees that are there. And our forecasters work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Then we also have 13 river forecast centers, of which one of them is here in Portland with us. And they do all the forecasting for the entire Columbia River forecast basin area. We have, I think it's 22 Central Weather Service units. There's one in Seattle that are located with the TRACONs for the air traffic control. And they're briefing air traffic controllers who are trying to decide, which runways are we going to use and which ones need to close and do we need to reroute aircraft and do we need to put more fuel on the planes. So they're embedded with those TRACONs, talking to those people daily. And then we have national centers, and everybody's probably most familiar with the National Hurricane Center. You know, that one's down in Miami, and when the big hurricanes are hitting, they're all over the national news. The Storm Prediction Center is another one in Norman, Oklahoma, that do the severe weather watches. So if you hear that there's a tornado watch, severe thunderstorm watch, and they also do fire weather outlooks, which I don't think everybody really recognizes that they're doing some of that as well. The Weather Prediction Center is looking at precipitation and snowfall and looking at the whole country as well, while the forecast offices are dialed into their local areas. Some of the other centers that may not be so well known is the Climate Prediction Center. When you hear us talk about a 30-day outlook or a 6 to 10-day outlook, the Climate Prediction Center does those. We have the Ocean Prediction Center. So out here on the West Coast, all the forecast offices forecast out to 60 miles, and then the Ocean Prediction Center takes over from there and does the rest of the Pacific Ocean. So then we just have our national headquarters. We have our regional. So our offices out here on the West Coast are part of the Western region of the United States, including kind of Montana and Utah and Arizona and everything to the west. So there's a lot there, but we have about 4,500 employees. We cost the average taxpayer about $4 a year. So I think that's a pretty good
That's a
bargain in
good
government.
bargain.
It is.
I ask
I'm worth
Alexa.
$4 a year.
Yeah. I ask Alexa about 3 times a day what's the temperature and what's the forecast. So
That's great. So yeah, we have a lot of employees, and 85% of them are out here in the field in your communities. We may not be right in your town in your backyard, but we're close enough to get there in a hurry if we need to.
okay. All right. That's a great summary. And then, on top of the National Weather Service, there is this National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. How does the National Weather Service fit in with them?
Well, you joked about acronyms a minute ago. We jokingly say it's the National Organization for the Advancement of Acronyms, NOAA.
Yeah.
But NOAA is the parent agency above the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service is the biggest line office within NOAA. But within NOAA, there's the National Ocean Service, the National Marine and Fisheries, Office of Atmospheric Research. There's NESDES, which does all of our satellites. So yeah, NOAA's got a climate program office. They're looking at, we kind of say we're from the seas to the skies, from the bottoms of the ocean all the way to the top of the atmosphere. NOAA has their fingers involved there.
Okay.
And we're
All
part of the
right.
Department of Commerce, and that might be an odd place. People go, Department of Commerce. But if you think about the impacts of weather on our economy, every time a flight gets canceled, that costs money. Anytime a train is derailed because of a storm, that costs money. So, our forecasts are out there not only just to protect life and property, but also to help make decisions to help improve our economy. Weather impacts a third of the gross domestic product every day somewhere in this country. And if you think about the oceans, there's a lot of talk in recent years about the blue economy and, with fishing and transportation of goods across the oceans. So, NOAA has its fingers in all of that, and it's all part of that Department of Commerce.
Okay. All right. Well, I one of the things I blog on and have other guests on involve technology, and technology is just omnipresent in every profession in that. And certainly it's a major component of what the National Weather Service does. So there have been some technological improvements that were significant here in the Pacific Northwest in fairly recent history. What improvements have been made, and what are the benefits of those improvements?
Well, the biggest one is probably the weather radar, the WSR 88D radar. They were developed in the 1980s and deployed in the mid 1990s. So, my first day on the job in Cheyenne, Wyoming, they were actually finishing up the radar installation. I was one of the first ones that got to see it be turned on. But now we're talking about They're old. They're getting old. They're 40 years past their prime, from the start of their development. And what's going to be next? Is it going to be the Doppler radar that we have right now on the coast, or is it going to be phased array radars that they need in the central part of the country to do 1-minute scans for tornadoes? Do we need gap-filling radars? And I'm going to say yes. My employer may not agree with me, but I'm going to say yes, we need gap-filling radars, especially along the central coast of Oregon. So radar is the big one. There was another one that was added on the western Washington coast after a significant event back in the mid-2000s. But they don't make them anymore. So, we really don't want what we currently have. We want what's next, what's coming next. And there's a lot of great scientific minds working on this in the academic and the public sector. And the private sector is going to have a piece of it too. They're willing to sell us all these radars, and they can do it at a lower cost probably today than what we did back in the 1980s and 90s. Other technologies is the advancement of our forecasting system. When I started, we would hand type out a 7-day forecast. Today, high of 52 and a low of 37, and partly cloudy skies with a 20% chance of rain. We hand typed all of that after looking at all these computer models. And they weren't the greatest computer models, they were at a very large scale. They couldn't really do a lot of the local impacts and the local effects that we see. Whereas today we have computer models that can get us down to, 3 and 4 kilometers scale that give us a lot more detail than we've ever had before. All of our forecasts are created from grids. So if you can think of a temperature map in your head, we would call that a grid. You would have, a temperature in Springfield, a temperature in Portland, a temperature in Seattle. Imagine that all in a graphic, and we have those for high temperatures, low temperatures, hourly temperatures, wind speed, direction, precipitation probabilities, how much precipitation is going to fall. All of those are in grids. And so we do graphical forecasting, and then we create the text automatically from that. So that was a huge, huge change in the early 2000s that came into the Weather Service. Our computers are getting faster. Our satellites are getting better. They're getting ready to launch GOES-U soon. The GOES series of satellites, if you think about what you see on TV, what you go on the internet and look at, some of the details that we can see are amazing, and we can get imagery every 5 minutes, which during a wildfire is huge.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a lot, right? So I've got a history technological question, and that goes back to warning people. And when I got into the biz way back when, we had the Emergency Alert System, EAS, and then NOAA
Are you
weather
sure it wasn't
radios.
EBS?
Well, I take it back. It was EBS. We transitioned to a digital environment.
Yes, we did.
And we also, through the Weather Service, and I know you're a weather warning, so you knew Ted Beener out here, Tornado Ted or Tsunami Ted, whatever he goes
He
by.
was Tsunami Ted, and he called me Tornado Tanya.
Okay. And he's still doing weather, by the way.
I know.
Being retired from the radio station, I think being an umpire for softball, baseball. But anyway, that's when I got introduced to NOAA weather radios. So, but today we have all these cellular phone-based warning systems. Is NOAA weather radio still a critical component? I noticed you had technicians dedicated to that. Is
It
it a back?
absolutely is. I went through a shooting in our town in Glasgow, Montana, when I lived there. It was horrible. Small town, 3,500, everybody knows everybody. But the minute the shooting happened at our hospital, the first thing that jammed up were the cell phones. Couldn't rely on it. The local phone cooperative had to come in and bring what's called a cow. I didn't know
Yeah.
that until then. They
A
had to bring cows in.
cell on wheels.
And bring them in and be able for just for law enforcement to be able to have that and communicate with all the responding agencies from other counties coming in to assist. So, you know, cell phones are critical. They're everybody's number one. I'm not going to tell anybody not to use their cell phone for warnings, but it can't be your only source. You have to always have a backup. One of my mentors, that was the best advice he ever gave me, was always have a backup. And NOAA weather radios, they're not on the same transmitters as your cell phones are. So if one goes down, hopefully the other one is still viable. NOAA weather radios will wake you up in the middle of the night. You know, a lot of us put our phones on do not disturb. But if there's a tornado warning or a tsunami warning in the middle of the night, you want to probably hear it and be able to take action. So, you know, they're anywhere from $30 to $50. They're easily programmable. You can have them. I know, you know, a lot of agriculture people like to have it. They can put it in their tractors as they're doing their plowing. Aviation folks can get it on their radios while they're coming in and flying in and landing. And they cover the majority of the country. I'm not going to say it covers everywhere, but there are legislative bills happening right now out of Washington. Senator Cantwell has one to increase NOAA weather radio transmitters around the country so that people have access. Because that's the number one thing you see a lot, maybe not as much as it was 10 years ago, but people say, well, it hit without warning. Well, rarely did it really hit without warning. It's
That's
just
right.
you didn't have the capability to get it.
Yeah.
So, weather radio might be old school and antiquated, but let's move some of it to the cloud too. Let's make it a little more modern. And, you know, we have good partners in that. Midland Radio is one of them. There's a lot of them that want to change and improve with us.
Okay. And it's just redundancy is what you
Yep.
always say. Don't have a single system, so multiple systems is great. I'm just looking here more on the warning. One thing I just have to say, compliments the National Weather Service. In my personal life as emergency manager, I remember in 1993, we were, if you will, surprised with the Inauguration Day windstorm up in central Puget Sound because it was not in the forecast. It maybe became an immediate thing, but we didn't know it. It kind of bumped in us. But I have not seen that type of surprise event. Generally, you guys have really gotten good at identifying the potential for, different events to be happening. And I watch the national news, and tornadoes are not as prevalent as in the Midwest where I grew up, but they can see all the things, pieces coming together that 2 days from now, there's a good chance we're going to have a tornado outbreak type deal.
Yeah,
So.
you know, we have gotten so much better than where we started from. We still have issues with temperatures right around freezing and that freezing rain, snow issue. We can still be surprised. February 22nd in Portland this past year, we were surprised. You know, we had about an inch in the forecast saying it could be as much as 3 inches, depending on your elevation. And we ended up with 11 inches at the airport and shut the city down. You know, so one of the things we're trying to transition to is communicating probabilistically. So rather than giving you a black and white answer, which a lot of people still want, but our emergency management partners need to know that there is that small chance that it could be worse than what we're forecasting. Or it could actually be better than what we're forecasting for. So, you know, when it comes to things like heat, you know, if we're going to put 105 degrees in there and a low of 80, well, what's the probability of that? How confident are we in that forecast? Because that really impacts how long they need to have heating and cooling centers, not heating in the summer, but cooling centers open. The same with cold weather in the wintertime. Same with the snow amounts, Department of Transportation's. They want to be able to staff up. They want to be able to bring in enough people, even on the off chance that, you know, we're going to get 6 inches of snow instead of two.
Right.
That's going to require additional resources. So you want to be able to stage that ahead of time. I'm thinking of the recent event that we just had through here, starting around January 12th and 13th, when we had the snow, the sleet, the high winds, but the real cold that came in. You know, they were able to open up 12 shelters in the city of Portland and bring in 1,800 people. They need 800 volunteers to do that. You can't do that with 24 hours notice.
Right.
So, you know, we try to dial in as we get closer, but, you know, 10 days out, we're saying, hey, there's something up and there is a small chance, or we're very confident it's going to get really, really cold and meet your criteria for opening those centers.
Okay. Well, this has been great kind of getting the scope and the National Weather Service, some of the details and technology. But folks, we're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking a bit more broader scale with those two words of El Nino and climate change, or two terms, I should say, and that'd be four words. I can't count. But stand by for this message, and we'll be right back.
Most organizations have access to incredibly powerful technologies, but struggle to use them to their full potential. Bent Ears team of experienced technology and operations professionals systematically help organizations get the most out of the technology they already own. You can find them at www.bentearsolutions.com.
And we are back talking today with Tanya Franson with the National Weather Service in Portland, Oregon. And Tanya, I got kind of a long question I've written out here. I watch the national news, and you know, for local news, if it bleeds, it leads type of thing. It seems like the weather has been a really big leading story with national newscasts with the major networks. So you're likely to hear about severe weather impacting people and property. And most recently, we're here in February now. It was California in the news with two successive atmospheric rivers impacting them, and then extending also into the Pacific Northwest. What is going on with the weather and all the extremes we've been seeing nationally? It was not that long ago that California experienced severe drought, and they're not in severe drought anymore, at least for the time being.
One season they got out of
Yeah. And so what role is El Nino maybe playing in all this, as opposed to climate change, or what's the diagnosis, doctor, of what's going on?
right. So we traditionally focus in on 7 days of forecasting, but all of these other climatological weather types certainly come into play with what we're forecasting. And we have things like El Nino, where the Pacific Ocean at the equator is warmer than normal, which will shift the jet stream to the north typically, which normally means warmer and drier conditions in the western US when that's happening. But this year we have a moderate El Nino. And so then it kind of goes a little bit out the window. For the Portland area and kind of the Washington, Oregon area, we've had eight moderate El Ninos in the past. Three of them were above normal precipitation, three of them were below, and two of them were right around normal. So when we were doing our outlooks this spring, I kind of cautioned. I said, there's an elephant in the room here, and you can't guarantee that it's always going to be warmer and drier than normal because it was forecast to be a moderate El Nino. The other thing, when we tell people warmer and drier, that means over the 3 month time frame, you know, for winter, December, January, February, it doesn't mean you're not going to get an event like we had here in the Willamette Valley that really caused damage and brought our precipitation above normal. It means over that 3 month time period overall, even if you're 2/10 of a degree warmer, it's technically verified, right? If you take
Yeah.
all those extreme temperatures and verify it. So El Niño is just one oscillation that we look at. We have the Madden-Julian oscillation, which impacts shorter-term things out in that 6 to 10 day period. We have the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. We have the Arctic Oscillation. I would really love like somebody to go in and create a mixer, and you go, okay, we're a positive Pacific Decadal, and we're a negative Arctic Oscillation, and we're neutral with the ENSO, the El Niño cycle. And it kind of gives you a play-by-play. But the thing is, we don't have enough data for all of those to give us a really good play-by-play. So we look at climatology, we look at what's happened in the past, and we look at what the climate models are showing us looking forward. You're asking about atmospheric rivers. People seem to think this is a whole new concept, and it's really not. It's just that the research and the publications are there's a lot more being done. The Scripps Institute down at UC San Diego has done a lot of work in this realm, especially in the last 10 years. And, we like to use certain terms. I know people have talked about Pineapple Express. Typically, these events do originate in warmer waters over by the Hawaii area, but some of the ones we've had have actually been further north than Hawaii. So maybe not quite as warm core as some of them are. But, satellite imagery is helping us see them. The radar imagery, as we're coming into the coast, we're able to identify these a lot better than we did 20 and 30 years ago. Now, let's talk about extremes. Climate change is happening. Climate is changing out there. You can't put 8 billion people on this planet and not have some sort of impact. And so we do see more extremes. Can I tell you that the event that we had here in Portland 3 weeks ago was climate change? I can't, not as a meteorologist sitting here doing a 7 day forecast, but there are people that look at those things.
Well,
But
my next question's on this, so why don't we talk about
yeah,
it?
no, I'm going to jump back. We'll go to that when you get to the next question.
Okay,
But
all right.
we are seeing more extremes. There's no doubt. We have written records that go back 150 years in a lot of these places. We are seeing that things are warmer overall. Our overnight lows, we're not seeing as many record-breaking lows as we used to, but we're seeing a lot more record-breaking warm lows and a lot more record-breaking temperatures. We're seeing more daily precipitation records. It's happening. And the other thing is we have a lot of people out here on the West Coast. And so we've got way more people that are in the way of the threat. Former FEMA director Craig Fugate was very famous for saying there are no natural disasters, only human-caused ones, because without the humans, it would just be an event, right? But you put humans in there, and now we've got, vehicles being, wrecked because trees are coming down on them. You've got landslides coming down on houses. So now we're seeing the impacts. And the more people you have, the more impacts you're going to have. So there's a whole lot of pieces and components coming into play here. But yeah, it is getting more extreme. The 2021 heat dome that we had over the Pacific Northwest was certainly very anomalous. I mean, the way the temperatures were 10 to 20 degrees above the previous highest temperatures was, you can't ignore that.
And I want to say, you might have this on the tip of your tongue. I want to say that Portland experienced upwards of 300 deaths attributed to the heat. Do you remember the number?
I have a report on the other side of my desk here, but it was several hundred across the Pacific Northwest for sure. And there's a great image that I saw several years ago at the National Severe Weather Workshop. Dr. Larry Kalkstein was there, and he has developed heat health warning systems across the United States. And he showed us a picture in Arizona the day before a heat event. And then 3 days later, and the picture looked exactly the same. We didn't see the devastation. We didn't see roofs smashed in, cars flipped over, flooded, communities. And so I don't think people think about heat as seriously as some of these other events where we can see the visible damage. And so I think that heat dome event was kind of a wake-up call for many. It was for us meteorologists as well.
Yeah. And heat now is the number one natural disaster killer in the United States, and I would say probably worldwide also.
Globally, yeah.
Well, you want to think, we talked to Atmospheric River, and the news media has a great way of propagating terminology, but the old bomb cyclone, that was a new term thrown out there, I want to say a couple of years ago, for big snowstorms coming out of the Arctic or winter storms and that. So, yeah, we got to make it
sick. Sometimes it gets people's attention. Some of them actually are formalized in official, the American Meteorological Society, you know, glossary of weather terms. Some of them are not, but if it gets people thinking about it and talking about it, I'm going to have to be okay with it. I'll be honest, a couple of years ago, the Climate Prediction Center used Godzilla or something in the description of a La Nina event or something coming in. I'm like, really? We sunk to Hollywood levels, but it gets people talking and it makes them start thinking about, well, how is this going to impact me?
And well, you would be familiar with this. There's talk about naming big storms now, just like hurricanes are named, right?
Yes.
To
so
help.
The National Weather Service doesn't do that. That was done by the Weather Channel on their own.
Oh, okay.
In and of itself, I don't think it's a bad idea, but hurricanes have a pretty definite start and end. And some of our winter storms that start on the West Coast and go all the way to the East Coast have a lot of changes along the way. So I don't know if you can keep naming something the same one way to the other, but if it's getting people's attention and making them think a little bit about what does this mean to me, I personally, and this may not be the opinion of my employer, I'm okay with that.
Okay. All right. And you were talking earlier, I just learned about this a couple of years ago, that following some major climate disasters, there's attribution studies that are being conducted to determine if climate change was a factor. So who's doing those? And is the National Weather Service part of those studies in any way?
You know, the data that we have collected from our cooperative weather observers, our automated surface observing systems at airports that are official temperature and precipitation measurements, all of our data is used, but we just don't have time at a local forecast office level to get that deeply involved with it. You know, we go from one event right to the next to the next. And so a lot of this work, the first time I recall seeing this done was after the significant flooding in Colorado, about 10 years ago or so. And I saw a climate attribution study done for that one. But there are people within NOAA that are doing this work from our climate program office. They are looking at the bigger, broader picture of things. And also academia, the academic circles really want to be able to go in and take a look at these and be able to decide, you know, is this just a routine event or is there something that's going on that's causing it to be worse than it normally would be? So I'm not going to say that one event was caused by climate change, but I'm not going to say it's not either.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that to those climatologists and those researchers that do that work that have the time to spend and look at it. But either way, does it matter if climate change caused it or not? Because there were still impacts. There's still recovery. There's still dollars lost. There's time lost. And we want to make sure that people are getting prepared. That's the one thing, my message here is just being prepared.
Yeah. Well, I always tell folks the emergency manager's role in all of this is climate adaptation. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make any difference what is causing it. We have to deal with the aftermath of it. So, well, let me give you a spot weather observation. It's having a significant rain shower in Springfield, Oregon, right now. On the 8th.
We had showers in the forecast.
You did have showers, but that's a. Time mark, 8 February at 12:44.
Do you have the mPing app on your phone? It's the
I
letter
don't.
M and the word ping. You can download that app and you can report precipitation anytime it happens.
Well, I'd be reporting it all the time. That's in. I
I
always tell
hear
people,
you.
if you want, visit the Northwest. Well, I was in Washington for many years and still split time up there. I always tell them, come after the 4th of July. Sometime shortly after the 4th of July, it'll stop raining for most of July, August, and into September. And if it hasn't started raining by the end of September, it will rain in October. That's my extended forecast.
You want to laugh? I moved here June 20th and it stopped raining. We had had a really wet June up until the day I got here. I had 2 days, I think, that summer that I measured any precipitation in my
There you
rain
go.
gauge. And then in October, I went to fly back to see my sons in Montana. And it was October 21st, and I was sitting there waiting for the Uber to come pick me up, and it started to rain, and it rained for 7 days straight. So I thought that I was kind of the cause. I kept asking, are we in drought yet? And they're telling me no. And are we in drought yet? And finally in August, I think they decided to go abnormally dry. Had we gone that long in Montana, we'd have been in a lot of trouble. But it was certainly a learning lesson for me. But it ended up being the driest summer on record when I showed up. So maybe there's a climate attribution there.
And for everybody think, well, that doesn't so bad, sound so bad for the Pacific Northwest. There is a term called Junuary, which that's when it's not so sunny, wet, extremely cool. Okay. I recall not that many years ago when members of the National Weather Service could not use the words climate change when discussing weather patterns. So what's the policy level guidance today for you guys? Certainly we've been talking about when thinking about planning forward, discussing climate change publicly. It would seem, based on this conversation, that there's no restrictions whatsoever.
You know, it was back in September of 2023 that we got our first official, here is our talking points for climate change. We had waited for a very long time for this. And there were some people that had been given the blessing that, yes, you can be out there and speaking about this, but they were kind of our big wig NOAA scientists that were doing a lot of work, but they're recognizing that our forecast offices and our forecasters are getting asked this all the time.
Yes,
So,
right.
yeah, they finally gave us some talking points. And, you know, NOAA actually created a strategic plan last year called Climate Ready Nation. That's a
What's the second word? Climate.
Climate Ready Nation. So you've heard about Weather Ready Nation.
Okay.
NOAA is looking at climate ready so that people are prepared for changes in the weather patterns that they're dealing with. So it's a big deal at the NOAA level. We haven't really seen a lot of it trickle down to our local forecast office level yet on what do they want us doing at that level and how do we communicate resiliency and preparedness into communities.
Okay, all right. Well, not everybody maybe is interested. I live out here, so I'm interested.
Yeah, look up, just Google Climate Ready Nation and you'll find the plan.
Okay, how do you spell that? How do you spell that word?
Climate
No, not climate.
Ready
Ready nation.
Nation.
I got it. I thought the ready nation was a word. I didn't get the is it hyphenated?
Sorry.
Is it
Nope.
hyphenated? No.
Three separate words. We have a
Okay.
weather ready nation is the Weather Service's goal. We want all of our public, all of our partners to be ready when the weather becomes extreme and causes impacts.
Okay. I'll look that up. That's something I could blog on, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So back to the Pacific Northwest. I shared it's really gotten much better, National Weather Service forecasts and The partnership with emergency managers is greatly appreciated. But what's the long-term forecast for the Pacific Northwest in terms of climate change impacts? And this is what I predict, being the scientist that I am not, is it would appear Pacific Northwest is not going to have as many, excuse me, severe weather impacts as other parts of the nation. I think drought, heat, lack of availability of water is really going to impact the Pacific or the Southwest and West, Western states. And we could see actually climate refugees, people thinking, well, if I have to go somewhere, a place that's perhaps a bit cooler from a temperature standpoint, looks like the Pacific Northwest. And they got mountains and they got snow. But up here, I'm a little concerned that our snowpack is our water reservoir from year to year. So if we start to lose snowpack, we'll also have some water issues, especially as our population continues to build. So am I way off base or?
I actually know two climate refugees. One moved from California up here, so it'd be cooler. And one moved from here to Bellingham, Washington, because Portland was getting too hot.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting to hear that term climate refugees, but people are trying to find better places to live. So the National Climate Assessment was released several months ago, the fifth one, and they're getting better and better and more detailed with each report. From where I first read it when they did the second one many, many years ago, if you just Google National Climate Assessment and then put the number 5 there, you're going to get the report. I'm going to just read to you a couple of bits and pieces from this report, because this was done in cooperation with private sector, academic sector, and the public sector across the nation. Many different universities participated, many agencies from Department of Energy to NOAA to USDA, lots of agencies all participated in putting these reports together. But there's one chapter, I think it's chapter 27, is on the Pacific Northwest. And it talks about that the annual average temperature in the region has risen by almost 2 degrees since 1900. Now, 2 degrees, if I told you the forecast today was 55 and we hit 53, that's not going to be really measurable, is it? But over time, that is. They say Oregon has actually warmed by 2.5 degrees, and they're expecting that the, you know, relative to 1900 to 2020, the number of extremely hot days and warm nights has been above the long-term average for the past decade. The number of extremely cold nights has been below average, so we're not as cold as we used to be. Future warming in the region is expected to exacerbate regional heat wave intensities. All right, so we had the 2021 heat wave. We had one in August last year that was kind of significant, but we were able to get enough notice out there that hopefully we reduced some of the impacts. But also, declines in mountain snowpack. Okay, if it's going to be warmer, your snow levels are going to be higher. You're going to still get some of that rain in there, but you're not going to have the snowpack. And you want that, what we call time-released precipitation. You want that precipitation to slowly melt out and go into the ground and into the aquifers and to fill the reservoirs. Summer precipitation is projected to decline under these scenarios, although it will be variable, meaning we might still see those extreme heavy precipitation events in a short time period. Also, you know, frequent, longer, more severe regional drought conditions, which would lead to increased wildfire risk and decreased water. And we both know how impactful water is. Those, they've been saying for decades, that's the water wars of the West. That's the war in the future, right, is over water. And there's compacts and treaties that have been in place for 100 and some years that were put in place before we started seeing a lot of these changes. the snow line going up means the Northwest glaciers will recede. The glaciers are certainly a source of water for our lakes and, you know, contribute to an average of, the glaciers contribute to an average of 30 to 45% of total winter precipitation. The atmospheric rivers helping grow the glaciers, contributing to the water.
Okay.
So, you know, the other thing, we've got marine heat waves now. Those are impacting our fish and our wildlife. And what does that mean for us? If it's warmer and it's drier, that means certain bugs might be more resilient than they used to be. And they might last longer. And those insects might, you know, eat trees. And so there's just all these ecological impacts that can occur as well.
Well, there's beetle kill of pine forests up in Canada because the temperatures have not gotten as cold that would normally kill off the bugs, so they're having a much greater impact. And quadra mussels, if you've heard of those at all, that's an invasive species we're trying to keep out of fresh water in the Pacific Northwest, but they are making their march north as part of it.
And cheatgrass, when you have high precipitation in the autumn and the spring, you know, if it grows and gets extensive when wildfires come in the summer, that's a source for those fires just to run
right
through. So,
yeah,
it's, you know, it's a lot to think about. It's a heavy problem. There are things we can do to make it better, but really it's got to be in the policy realm. You know, individually there's things we can do. I drive a hybrid now. I love seeing how many hybrid and electric vehicles we have up here, but you know, we're one people. We need the policy side of things to kind of help decide how we're going to fix these problems.
Well, Tanya, this has been good. Is there anything else you'd like to share that we didn't touch on, or is there something you want to emphasize coming out of this?
You know, I just want to go back to you being prepared. You know, the Weather Service has our website, weather.gov. It's 24/7. It's actually going to be updated. It's going to have a whole new look and feel by this summer. Going to be easier and a little more intuitive for the average person to use.
And that's nationally?
That's across the whole country. Yep.
Okay.
So we're getting better. We're not perfect, and we'll never be perfect on a forecast. We're going to try. our models are getting better. Our collaborations with academia is getting better on testing different things to see what works better. How do we communicate? The social side of it is super important too. You know, I think about the recent event. We had winds 30 to 40 miles an hour gusting to 50 in our winter storm warning. We talked about trees coming down and power lines coming down, but what we should have been talking about is tornado safety. You know, if you live in a home that's surrounded by large trees, you should be in the lowest level surrounded by as many walls as you can. So we're constantly learning from every event and trying to communicate it better in such a way that people see themselves in that scenario and find a way to be prepared to respond and, you know, protect themselves. So we can also build better, right? You know,
when
you get used to buying the cheapest thing. And we always focus on what the countertops are going to look like and what the tile in the bathroom is. But we should be looking as, did they put the correct strapping on there and the correct hurricane straps in the houses we're buying, making our homes more resilient and ready for these events as well.
I'll send you an op-ed I did on that fact. You know, it's not all about stainless steel, right?
No, it's not.
Okay. Well, I just want to say thank you to Tanya Frentzen for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
I'm glad you invited me, and I would love to be invited back someday, Eric.
Okay. Hey, you have a standing invitation. I'd just say, we got to wait 6 months. So they can't remember, and I can't remember what we talked about, but I'll have a record here. But one of the great partners of emergency management everywhere is the National Weather Service. They are critical to our mission effectiveness, and I encourage everyone to be on a first-name basis with their weather office staff wherever you live and work. And now a reminder to everyone, be safe and think about what you can do today, just as Tanya has talked about. It's not everybody has a role to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast, please share a link to it with your social media contacts. Thanks for listening and be safe.
Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.